Hi, this is Gideon Rothstein with a responsum a day for the 26th day of Adar. Thank you to the OU, to Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, and to David Hochhauser for putting these shirim online, making them available to you. Today we're going to see a responsum of the Chatam Sofer from the fifth volume of Chatam Sofer in the Choshen Mishpat section, Simon Tzadi Tet, responsum number 99. And it's about a specific case, but it brings up many interesting and important broader halachic concepts. So the case was a certain man, we'll call him Reuven, purchased 26 barrels of Yain Shmarim, which is like vodka or schnapps, vodka, from another guy, from Shimon. Now, Shimon still retained physical possession of the barrels because this Reuven wasn't ready to take full delivery yet. But in performing the sale, this Reuven, the purchaser, had given all the money right away. That's going to become an issue. So he gave all the money right away, and he measured out the vodka from barrel to barrel. He took the vodka from the original barrels. He measured out, using measuring tools of the cellar, but he measured it out into other barrels of the cellar. So in terms of the barrels and who owns the barrels, it's clear the cellar owns the barrels. But he's done this action of measuring out the thing, meaning if I have 26 barrels and I'm selling you and you want to be sure that you're getting the full amount of the 26 barrels, so one of the things you'll do is you'll measure out to make sure that the contents of the barrels are exactly what they're supposed to be. And that's what he had done. And then he had also put a sign on the barrels into which he placed. Now, these barrels the barrels clearly belong to the seller, but the purchaser had placed a marking on the barrel saying, these are barrels of vodka that I have measured out and that I have purchased and that are mine. It's because he didn't. That's the custom among merchants of the time, is that that signifies a full sale of the material, of the items within the barrels to the purchaser. However, importantly for our purposes, he never formally did an action of mishicha. Mishicha is when one draws an item to oneself, or hagba would be when one lifts an item to oneself, and those are ways that halakhically one acquires an item. So the question is going to be, who is the owner of this vodka? And it's going to become an issue because sometime after this sale, a fire broke out in the seller's storehouse. Okay, the seller's not living in the storehouse, he's living right near the storehouse. The storehouse is part of his, you know, household, part of his estate, but it's in the room where all of the vodka was stored. Now, in the report to the Chatam Sofer about the case, they talk about this strong wind. There was a strong, strong wind, which would therefore blow the fire and make it spread faster, which had not been seen for many, many years. You know, it was like a once-in-a-decade storm, basically, is what they're trying to say, including the wind. And the house, the seller's house, got burned with all of his vodka, including the vodka that belongs to the purchaser. Now, the purchaser obviously wants to say, it wasn't mine. You owe me 26 barrels of vodka. Now, part of what the seller is claiming, aside from the usual stuff, the usual claims are going to be things like the purchaser had already bought the vodka. It belonged to him completely. But in addition, the seller wants to say he had no ability to have saved anything, because we're going to get into also questions of shomrim. Right? One question is, who owned the vodka? Let's suppose the seller owned the vodka. Then for sure the purchaser is correct that he needs to have the vodka delivered to him, because he never took delivery and it didn't belong to him. That would be one claim the purchaser is making. A second claim the purchaser could be making, though, is that even if you grant that for whatever reason I am considered the owner of record on the vodka by virtue of the ways that we sold it, nonetheless, you, seller, were supposed to be a shomer. You were supposed to watch this vodka for me, and you did not fulfill that responsibility, and therefore you have to pay me back for the vodka even if I already was the owner. So that partial response to that claim, the seller says there was no way he could have saved the vodka. That's first of all because the fire started in the storehouse, in the storeroom where the vodka was kept. So that by the time the seller doesn't live in that room. The seller lives somewhere else within the house. But by the time he knew about the fire, the flames were already coming out the windows, meaning the flames were already significant enough. There was no way to run in. Now, we're going to see later, there was some way to run in, because we're going to see the people who stole stuff from there. But he couldn't really run in, he claims, first because there was too much fire. But then also, there is, in that state, in that country, wherever they were living, there was a rule that if a fire goes out of a Jewish house, now let's remember that fire in the 1800s, even in the 1800s, was still, that reminded me, I'm sorry to interrupt myself, but I didn't tell you that this is a response from the 26th of Adar of Tuf Kuf Ayin Vav of 1816. Sorry. Tafkuf Ayin Vav, 1816. So in 1816, fire was a serious issue. You still had, into the 1900s, you had whole cities could get wiped out by fires. Large neighborhoods could be wiped out by fires because the structures were made of wood. And when a fire got going, it could be very strong and it could go. I mean, the truth is, even now in the 2017, if you think about California, you have these wildfires that spread and houses can get destroyed. So in those days, fire was a serious issue. So it seems that wherever they were living, the rule was made that if there was a fire in a Jew's house, you could throw the owner, the Jew, into the fire. Now, I'm not sure if this was an anti-Semitic law or if it was a law that was made regarding any homeowner whose house caught fire, and if it was a way for the authorities to try to make sure that people were very careful not to have fires that could spread. I have no idea if that's true. It's phrased here as if it's both. It's clearly also oriented, trying to make sure that people don't be very extra careful about fires starting. But it sounds like there's an anti-Semitic element here as well, that you could throw the Jew into the fire. And therefore, the point is, as soon as the seller who lives there realizes there's a fire, he had to flee. He had to flee because otherwise people would throw him into the fire. So the purchaser now is claiming either the vodka or the money. Now, whatever the response the Rav Chaim Sofer is going to give, and we'll get to it in a second, there's a certain amount. These are always situations where you wonder how insensitive various people are being, because the seller responds that not only didn't he have the vodka, but the money got burned up as well, because he, you know, the fire came, he ran away, and remember, money in those days was made of metal, so if the fire burned strong enough, the metal gets melted down, he's got nothing, and he never got a chance to use the money, and so he's really stuck. Now, it's possible that the purchaser is also somebody who's in financial straits, and therefore he feels the desperate need to, in some way, recoup these losses. But at least from the simplest reading of the tshuva, of the response, it seems like the seller is the one who is in more dire straits. He's just lost everything in a fire, and now this guy's coming after him for his vodka as well. So it could be that I'm wrong. It could be that the seller was a very rich man, and this was a loss, but a loss he could easily absorb, whereas the purchaser was a much poorer man, and he needed those 26 barrels of vodka, or at least the money that he put into them, much more. So I can't know who is in the moral, you know, aside from the technical legalities, from the legal technicalities, what I really meant to say, aside from that, who's in the moral high ground? But that's the way it reads in the question. So, Chatzos Sofer says the first thing that has to be figured out, you have to do an investigation to know how did the fire start. If we believe, or we have some evidence, or he takes an oath of the seller, that he was in no way negligent regarding the start of the fire. That's a very important piece of the puzzle, and Chasam Sofer says, I have no way of knowing that from this tshuva, you have to figure it out. And the Shulchan Aruch, he points out, the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Tov Yud Chet has a discussion about what constitutes negligence regarding fires, and that I think also would be a matter that might change in various times and places, but if the person was negligent regarding the fire, so that's going to be a problem, then the seller's going to be on the hook for it, because he was negligent. Negligence is almost always a problem, and something where the person was negligent has to pay it back. Because, as the Chatzam Sofer points out, in cases of Tekilat Tobe Pshia, where a case starts out as negligence, then even if later on things went beyond his ability to rectify the situation, to affect the situation, it won't matter that much, and he'll be on the hook for it, because the negligence is what started the ball rolling. And then he says, but other types of onus, of that being beyond the ability of the seller to save anything, I'm not convinced is custom silver. So, for example, the man mentioned, the questioner had mentioned the idea that the fire was already coming out of the windows, which seems to have meant it was an onus in terms of saving things from the fire. So Chatzos Sofer says, I think that we only use that as a standard of it being beyond the capability of the seller to save something if it's passed over a fence, or if it's gone over, let's say, from one house to the next, meaning from one place to the next. But if it's within one reshut, one home, the fact that the fire rises to a certain extent, he's not sure that qualifies as an onus in terms of saving things. Another piece of the puzzle was that while the seller was claiming the money got burned up in the fire, the man writing to the questioner, the man writing to Chatzos Sofer, would be like a rabbi who's involved in this case, not either one of the litigants, he says he's not sure. Maybe we have to worry that the money was actually not burned up, but stolen by the people who ran into the house during the time of the fire. So that would change our perspective of it, because if we treat the seller as a shomer sachar, so this is always this is the topic that we were going to get to, right? What qualifies, what kind of a shomer is the seller, meaning the seller sold the vodka. So one option is the seller is still the one owner of the vodka. The sale doesn't go through. We'll get to that. We'll get to that below, right? Why wouldn't it go through? But let's say if it theoretically could have not gone through. Let's say it did go through. So if it went through, then these barrels of vodka containing in them vodka that belongs to the purchaser, and the seller is watching it. Now, depending on the kind of a watch person the seller is, according to halakha, then his responsibilities shift accordingly. So if he's a shomer chinam, for example, if he was just watching it for free as a favor, meaning I sold the guy the vodka, he doesn't want to take delivery yet, as a favor to him, I'll watch it for him. So then his level of obligation to watch it would be at a much lower level. He'd basically only be responsible for negligence, as we spoke about already. But the man writing to Chatam Sofer had suggested maybe he should qualify as what's called a shomer sachar, as a watch person who's being paid, because after all, first of all, he's being paid for the vodka, and maybe some of that price, sale price, includes in it his sale, he's watching it for him. If that would be true, then he's watching for this man. Maybe the money is included in that. He's watching it for the man, meaning if you say the sale didn't go through, let's say that, if the sale didn't go through, then the money really still belongs to the purchaser. He's just sort of left it with the owner to confirm that they will have a sale in the future, and then it would be, and his level of obligation would be much higher in terms of saving the materials. But that doesn't matter, because even a paid watch person is only liable for what's called geneva v'aveda. Aveda means it's lost. Geneva means it's stolen by stealth, not by force. So if it's stolen by stealth, then the shomer sachar should have avoided that. He should have put it in a statement of place that a stealth robber couldn't just come and get it. But in this case, when it's by fire, so the Chatam Sofer says that's much more similar to what's called a listim mizuyan. A listim mizuyan is an armed robber. So a shomer sachar, somebody who's watching an item for somebody else for pay, is not liable for armed robbery. If you want to make somebody liable for armed robbery, you know, you can say I'm going to hire armed detectives who are armed watchmen, who are armed guards, and they're going to be liable. They're going to insure me against armed robbery as well. You can do that, but that would require a specific set of discussions that makes them obligated for that. But your ordinary paid watchman is not obligated at that level to avoid even a listim mizuyan, an armed robber. And here, it's certainly at that level of seriousness, says Chatam Sofer, because the rule, the law was that anybody who came along would have the right to throw this guy into the fire. So that's their weapon. They have the fire that they can throw him into. So even if they did have weapons of their own, the people coming to steal it. So if you're going to tell me the money got stolen, whoever stole it qualifies halachically, says Chatam Sofer, as a listim mizuyan, as an armed robber, because the arms, the weapon is the fire itself that this seller had to run away from to avoid being thrown into. So it really all comes back to whether the fire itself can be seen as out of the control of the seller, and that depends on how it started and the investigation to which the Chatam Sofer had referred earlier needs to be made about the start of the fire. Now another possibility is, perhaps we could say, that the mekach, that the sale had some flaw to it, and that the seller therefore becomes more like a borrower of the money. The money that's in his hands is more like he's borrowing the money for the present time until a sale goes through. And if he's a borrower, the borrowers are liable at a much higher level, including armed robbery, because they're borrowers, and borrowers have to pay it back no matter what happened to it. So that would be a reason to say that maybe the seller does have to pay him back. But the Chatam Sofer says you could raise all the ideas you want to, but he thinks the seller has enough halakhic grounds to refuse to pay it back. And let's remember that in halacha we say, ha-motzi mi-chaveru alav ha-ra'aya. If the purchaser wants to get something out of the seller now, he'd have to prove it, because the seller is the one who has, theoretically, who has the money, who's in possession of the item that the purchaser wants to get back, either the money or the vodka, and the seller is claiming he's not liable for it. to give it back, to pay anything and to give him anything. So if the seller wants to extract money from him in a court of law, he'll need to prove it. So the Chatzim Sofer is saying he doesn't think there's any way to prove it because he thinks the seller has reasonable grounds to claim that he is not liable for anything that went on here. So first, for example, we have a constant halacha that's called situmta, which is that anything that constitutes a form of acquisition by common custom, anything which the general world assumes is a form of acquisition, even if it's not one of the kinyanim, one of the forms of acquisition that appear in the Talmud and the Gemara, that will take full effect as well. So for the famous example on 47th Street in the Diamond District, the way to finish a sale, to complete a sale, is to shake hands and say, I think mazel bracha. I think there are non-Jews who know that as well and do that as well. That's the end of a sale. So let's suppose that either party to a sale which was done that way were to come to Beit Din and say, what are you talking about? Nobody gave money, which is not necessarily a big issue, because money is not seen as an effector of sales, but no diamonds, no jewelry, no merchandise passed hands back and forth, and therefore there was no sale in halachic terms. That's not a valid claim in halacha, because the minog of what constitutes a kinyan would qualify as a kinyan. So here, says the Chatam Sofer, the seller has the easy right to claim that the marking of the barrels and the signature by the purchaser, that's the full form of the sale. If that's true, then it's a tragedy that the vodka got burned up, but it's the vodka of the purchaser that got burned up. The reason why that's not a full argument, why that's not a complete argument, it just clinches the case and says that the purchaser has no claim, is that the Sma, an important commentary on Choshen Mishpat, the Sefer Mirat Einayim, which was written by the author also of the Drisha Uprisha on the Torah, very important, Achron Nimrav, I think, Rav Yehoshua Falk. See, he wrote that when somebody gives money as part of a sale, in the time Kol HaMa'ot, if he gave all the money, then whatever other form of acquisition was applied to this case doesn't count. He names Situmta, common forms of acquisition, or Chalipin. Chalipin is where we trade items, but it's usually done as a way to facilitate purchases. So Chalipin would be, let's say, the purchaser gives his handkerchief to the seller, and the seller therefore transfers ownership of the item. That's a full sale in halacha. But the Sma is saying, but if there was money given, the giving of the money indicates that we don't want those other forms of sale to take effect. And the reason the Sma gave for it was the same reason that the Gemara gives as to why money doesn't halachically generally affect sales on movable items. And that is, Shema Yomru Nisrafachitecha. Chazal were already worried, ironically for our case, were worried that if somebody purchased something else from somebody with money alone, that when they came to collect it, the seller might say, I'm really sorry, but there was a fire and your item got burned up. Which is exactly what's going on here, except here we don't distrust that the item got burned up. It's just that who owned the item when it got burned up and who's liable for the item when it got burned up. So the Sma is saying, so the Chatam Sofer was saying, he marked the barrels. That would mean that we had a kinyan situmta, and that would mean that the barrels really belong to the purchaser, and he's stuck in the exact way the Gemara predicted he might get stuck. But the Sma had said, now whenever money has passed hands, the Sma thinks that the gezeira of Chazal takes effect. The same way Chazal said money won't affect purchases on movable items in general because we're worried about fire and those kinds of situations, so too, wherever money passes hands, other forms of acquisition will not work as well. Now, that's a far-reaching claim by the Sma. It's not fully accepted by everybody. That's what the Chatzim Sofer's point is. If it was fully accepted, then the seller would be on the hook here. And the point isn't that everybody accepts it. It's that it's enough of a, if the Sma is enough of an authority, that you have to think about it and you have to take account of it in your halakhic ruling. So we couldn't rule against the purchaser that would tell him, no, sorry, you're stuck because you took possession by marking the barrels. That we can't do because the Sma says the transfer of money means that the marking of the barrels will not count, even though it ordinarily would count. So the Sma holds that way, but the Chatam Sofer points out that the Rama in Choshen Mishpat says, I can make a condition to have money alone affect the purchase. Meaning, the Sma was saying that when Chazal worried about money and fires and things like that going wrong after a money purchase, then that worry was so strong that Chazal said it would even mean that other forms of purchase would not take effect, like Chalipin. And I don't even know, I don't think the Sma would apply that even to Mashiach, to like him taking actual halakhic possession, but That's the kind of claim that's going on. The Ramah, however, felt that if somebody wants to make a tenai, wants to make a condition, even though Chazal say money won't affect the full sale, I want money to affect the full sale in our case. The Ramah thought that was okay. There are plenty of situations where we're allowed to, as Chazal will point out later, there are situations where we're allowed to say, Chazal made a takana, made a rule for my benefit, and even though that rule is for my benefit, or since that rule is for my benefit, I can forego that occasion. I can say, you know what, thank you, Chazal, I appreciate you looking out for me. In this case, I don't want to take advantage. There are lots of places in halacha where we allow that to be true. Example that pops into my mind is, Chazal made a rule that a woman's salary would go to her husband so that he would support her with mizonot, with food. But it was clear in the Gemara that if a woman wants to say, any nizonet ve'eni nosa, I won't be fed by my husband, and he won't get my salary. She's allowed to do that. And the reason she's allowed to do that is because Chazal's takana was made for her benefit. It's not that Chazal said, we prefer that a woman's salary go to her husband and that he be the one to support her. It's clear in the Gemara that Chazal said, we worry about her. We're not sure she'll have enough support. We want to make sure the husband understands he has to support her in terms of her food. In order to make sure he'll do that, any money she makes goes to him. But if she wants to change the rules on that, she's clearly allowed to. So here too, the Ramah said, it's true, Chazal made a rule about money being used for purchase not affecting a full sale to protect the purchaser. But if the purchaser wants to forego that, he has the right to do so. Now the Shach happened to agree with the Sma that he can't do so in that case, or he didn't agree with the Sma so much. He says the Shach there disagrees with the Ramah and says it's not true. You can't make a condition to have money affect the full sale. The Sma wasn't saying that money would affect the full sale, or would or wouldn't. The Sma was saying that money would push aside any other forms of kinyan, forms of acquisition that weren't direct acquisition for these reasons. So they seem to agree, the Sma and the Shach seem to agree that in our case, the presence of money should mean the sale wasn't fully affected, even by any form of purchase that we see could have happened, like the marking of the barrels, or the moving from one barrel to the other. But the Chatam Sofer says, I don't know. I'm not convinced. He says that when Chazal made this rule about money, they were saying, first of all, when you follow that view, it means that money, by Torah law, money affected full sales. So I think, says Chatam Sofer, when you see a purchaser provide all the money up front, which the seller was not requiring, then I think that means the purchaser is worried that if the sale doesn't go through completely, the seller will back out. Because remember, in halacha, when a sale hasn't been fully affected, either side can back out. Now, so let's say vodka is selling fairly cheaply right now. The purchaser, therefore, wants to get in on the vodka right now, and the seller would like the money now. So the seller is saying, yeah, I'll sell it now for this price. But if it, you know, in a month from now, for whatever reason, vodka is going to go up in price, and I can make a lot more money of it. So if the guy has left the stuff with me until then, he never gave me money for it, then I might say, hey, you know what? I want to back out of the sale. Halachically, it's not morally acceptable to do so. What I mean is sometimes halacha expresses both the technical law as well as its ideal version of what should happen. It's not morally, halachically good to back out on sales like that, but it's legally feasible. So the Chatam Sofer says, and I think that's why the purchaser will give all the money up front. He wants to make sure that the seller can't back out. Now, Chatam Sofer says, the purchaser could have had another way to avoid that problem, because Chazal said you can actually acquire it just by lifting it up and putting it down. And then even if you leave it in the possession of the seller, it's already fully yours. And then also he can't say, and then the seller could say, then yours got burned up. But if you're worried about that problem, him coming to you saying, oh, it's yours who got burned up, and you wouldn't know which were which, here you'll have picked it up and identified it, and you'll know which are which. So if the purchaser, therefore, decides to give the money when he had another way to make sure the seller couldn't back out on the sale, and that other way of making sure the seller couldn't back out on the sale seems to avoid the fire problem for reasons we're not going to go into. I think the Chatam Sofer means that if I pick them up and identify them and put them in a special place, then when the fire happens, it happens to me, not to him. And the worry was that if I don't identify which vodka, if the guy owns 100 barrels of vodka and 26 of them got burned, he'll say, oh, sorry, it's your 26 that got burned. But if I did mashiach on them, or if I pick them up and put them down, or I put them in a special place, we'll be able to identify which ones got burned up, and that's the worry. So I've avoided the fire worry in that sense. And yet I gave the purchaser gave the money anyway. So the Chatam Sofer thinks that's because Ihu de Afsi de Nafshi. He's just deciding to put the money into the equation, because he wants to firm up the sale. And it's not the same, he says, as what the Sma was talking about, where you make a condition that money should work in this situation, because then you're like making a condition, you're trying to make a condition against what Chazal said. But if you did a full acquisition, and we're going to get to a second why he thinks it's a full acquisition, you did a full acquisition anyway, plus gave the money, so there, the Chatam Sofer thinks that the giving of the money doesn't fall under the Sma's rule that, once you give him money, there's no way that it could be a full sale. So why is he here? Does he think the man must have made a full acquisition? Because he says that the custom of Situmta, of marking the barrels, he thinks it's good enough. And he thinks that's going out of your way to make a full acquisition. And he thinks that that qualifies even for what the Sma would have said. The Sma spoke about Situmta, but the Situmta of the Sma might have been a different kind of Situmta, like a shaking of hands. But here, where you did a physical action to the barrels and you showed them, so you're avoiding the problems of the fire issue because we know which are which, Chatam Sofer thinks that the money doesn't change anything. Not only that, he thinks it's also true that by giving the money, when Chazal said he didn't have to, he's saying that he doesn't want Chazal's rule to apply to him and help out to him, and he's just ignoring that he doesn't care about it, and he has the right to do so, as we've said before, because people have the right in certain situations where Chazal made it to kind of on behalf of people, those people might have the right to avoid it. Furthermore, says the Chatam Sofer, many authorities hold, or there are authorities who hold, that when you measure something, it becomes yours. Even if you use the measuring tools of the seller, so it's not that it becomes physically in your possession, it never becomes physically in your possession because you're measuring through the measuring tools of the seller, but just the act of measuring might qualify as an act of acquisition. He thinks that that's particularly true because the vodka got moved from one barrel to the other, and he thinks that it's hard to imagine a situation where in moving vodka from one barrel to another, you didn't pick it up at some point. And Hagbaha, picking up, is an act of acquisition al pi halacha, according to halacha, according to all opinions, and even if it's using the items of the mocher, of the seller, meaning even if you sell me a barrel of vodka, one barrel, let's say, and I pick it up. And so that's mine already, even though we both know that the barrel isn't becoming mine. I'm going to have to return the barrel to you at some point. Doesn't matter. I own the vodka now. So the observer thinks the process of measuring almost definitely would have had a picking up, an act of hagbaha to it as well. And there he thinks, by the way, once you think that if it's a hagbaha act, he thinks there's actually no way for the purchaser to say, I didn't buy it yet. The Sma, he thinks the Sma's argument only holds water for those forms of acquisition that would be rabbinic. But if the man gave the money and also did a Torah form of acquisition, which would be hagbah, which would be lifting up the item, so there the Chatam Sofer thinks there's no way that you can say, oh, but I didn't really acquire it, and therefore the fire doesn't become my problem. There's also, by the way, and the Chatam Sofer points out, the Baal HaMor understood this whole Takana of Chazal about money in the exact reverse way. It wasn't that they worried the seller would say, sorry, your wheat is the wheat that got burned up, or your item that got burned up, but that the Chazal were worried that purchasers would see a fire coming, they'd immediately renounce all their purchases, and then the sellers, who had a storehouse full of items they thought they had already sold, and they got money for, they would also have to return the money, because the purchaser would all back out of their purchases. So if that's true, then for sure, here, it doesn't help the purchaser because he's the one trying to claim, no, it was yours, but he never backed out. He would have had to actually back out in order for that to be true. Meaning the takana was, maybe he'll back out. And so unless he actually backed out, then you wouldn't think that it worked in terms of putting the burden of the fire on the seller. And then he says also there are opinions that talk about the fact that the seller has money and he had an extra time. That would only possibly make him a shomer sachar, right, which is at a paid watchman who would have a higher level of responsibility, if he was the kind of person whose business was in money, meaning he would lend an interest to non-Jews, let's say, and or he would be a money changer, and he would get to take commission, and he could do something with the money. But now are times when that person, that seller, is not that kind of a person, so therefore there's no reason to think of him as a paid watchman. He's got the money, but he can't do anything with the money other than use the money, but that's not enough to make him a shomer sachar. So for all of these reasons, the Chatam Sofer thinks that if we can show that the fire happened be'ones, was completely against anybody's ability to avoid, so the seller wasn't negligent in that way or wasn't in any way on the hook for that, then there's no way that we can take money, get money out of this seller, because he has more than enough arguments to say that this was an unfortunate event that happened to both of them. It happened to the seller in terms of the money and in terms of other vodka that he had, in terms of the purchaser, in terms of his vodka, because it was already his vodka in all the ways that we discussed. And that is a response of a day for the 26th of Adar, with thanks to the YouTuber, Jacob Romitz and David Hockhauser. Have a great day.